One of the benefits of a time of year like this when the nights are longer than the days is the chance to catch up on sleep, if that is possible. We'll have to ask about that. We have many questions about sleep and what it does for us, brains, body, moods, and more. And science has gotten a lot better at answering the questions in recent years. So there's a whole lot to learn in the book, Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams by Matthew Walker, Ph.D., professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, where he's the director of the Sleep and Neuroimaging Lab. He talks about sleep frequently in the media with appearances on 60 Minutes, Science Friday, and many more outlets. Why We Sleep is his first book for a general audience. Matthew Walker, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you give us a pretty good scare in paragraph two. What can happen if we don't sleep enough on a regular basis?
Well, sadly, every disease that seems to be killing us in the developed world, from cancer, Alzheimer's disease, even diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, stroke, and most recently suicide, all have significant links to a lack of sleep. We also know just from epidemiological studies a very simple truth, which is that the shorter your sleep, the shorter your life. That short sleep predicts what we call all-cause mortality. So every major system in the body and every process in the brain seems to be enhanced by sleep when we get it, or markedly impaired when we don't get enough.
In fact, you mentioned that you do lobby doctors to prescribe sleep. I wonder what kinds of reactions you've gotten from MDs when you made those requests.
Yeah, and I hope people don't mistake that for the idea of prescribing sleeping pills, which I think medicine now is fast understanding is not really the answer for a better night of sleep. But it's always struck me as strange. We know that sleep is the Swiss Army knife of health, as it were. It's, you know, no matter what problem you have, sleep is more than likely to have a tool in its box that will help you. And why don't doctors start thinking about sleep? Why don't they prescribe a good night? I think part of the reason is that it's not doctors' fault, because if you look at the education that they get, there's remarkably little about sleep that they are told. Despite a wealth of over 10,000 scientific studies, we don't educate our doctors about the critical benefits of sleep and the dangers of not getting enough, nor its diagnostic capabilities too, which are significant. So we need some kind of transformational change there within healthcare and medicine, and that's part of, I think, a discussion that happens in the book.
So doctors didn't go there, and the general public certainly has a sort of a love-hate relationship with sleep. We love to get it, but hate to commit the time to it, it seems like, in some cases. Why do we tend to give sleep such short shrift and put other priorities above it?
What we're realizing is that it's not just one thing that has caused this global sleep loss epidemic, and it does seem to be at epidemic proportions. There are numerous factors, and it's different for different people, but I can give you the key indicators. Firstly, I think sleep has an image problem in society, which is that we tend to stigmatize getting sufficient sleep with the label of laziness, that if you're getting your 8 hours, well, maybe you're a little bit slothful, or you're not busy enough, because busy people don't sleep, and that's one way that they show how busy they are. It's not just that, of course, though. We know that commute times are longer, and we also know that work hours are longer. So people are leaving the house earlier and coming home later. We also know that we are a dark-deprived society, which is a big problem. We don't get enough darkness at night, and we need that darkness to allow a hormone called melatonin to rise within our brain and trigger healthy onset of sleep. I think the other two problems perhaps are caffeine and alcohol and the use of them, or perhaps even you could say the abuse of them. Caffeine is now the second most traded commodity on the surface of the planet after oil. And I think that, you know, you don't need me to give you epidemiological studies and facts and percentages. That is perhaps one of the greatest demonstrations of how profound we are medicating our sleep deprivation state in society. And caffeine is keeping us awake at night, or it's preventing us from getting the deep sleep that we need. Alcohol, too, is a misunderstood drug. People think the nightcap helps them fall asleep. That's actually not quite true. Alcohol is sedating your brain. It's just knocking your brain out. It also fragments your sleep, so you wake up many more times. And sadly, alcohol also blocks your dream sleep. So I'm deeply unpopular when I give this advice. You know, no one likes to hear right. That they should, you know, stop caffeine use after 2 p.m. and stay away from alcohol. But I would be doing people a disservice if I didn't give them the scientific truth of those facts. So many different reasons why we're not sleeping enough.
Matthew Walker, you say in the book that why do we sleep was the wrong question. What is the right question then?
It was the wrong question, I think, early on in the field of sleep research in the 1950s and 60s, because we assumed that there was one single holy grail function or reason that we slept, and we went in search of it. And I think it was perhaps a wrong way to approach the question, because if you flip it around and you say, we're awake for two-thirds of our life, why are we awake for that two-thirds of our life? Well, we are awake for lots of different reasons. There are many benefits to being awake. Well, why wouldn't the same rule apply to that one-third of our sleeping lives? And now we understand that is exactly the case. There is a multitude, a constellation of nighttime benefits for your brain and your body that happen by way of sleep. So why are the reasons that we sleep, or what are the reasons for why we need sleep, is perhaps a better question than what is the single reason why we sleep.
We're on our way to a break here soon, but I want to ask how you ended up turning to sleep as a field of study.
I think we're all accidental sleep researchers in the field. No one, you know, raised their hands when they were 7 years old and said, when I grew up, I want to be a sleep researcher. And I fell into it accidentally by my research in dementia and got very interested in the sleep disruption. That was 20 years ago, and my love affair with sleep remains.
And it has given us this book, Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams, by Matthew Walker, PhD, at the University of California, Berkeley Sleep and Neuroimaging Lab. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange. What do you do to get to sleep? Are there things that really work well, things that haven't worked well for you? Share your thoughts by phone or email. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Matthew Walker and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are attempting to put you to sleep in this hour, but not right away. We are talking about the topic of sleep with Dr. Matthew Walker, professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. He runs the Sleep and Neuroimaging Lab there and has written a book called Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. It goes very deeply into why we should sleep deeply. And you can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 with questions, comments, stories. Emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. So, Matthew, the way you describe what goes on with us in sleep and all the things that seem to improve through sleep, it sounds like a general overnight maintenance, like the cleanup and tune-up crew comes into our body and mind.
It is a beautiful description, and we do know that every single organ and system within the body is overhauled. The immune system, the cardiovascular system, all of the aspects of your metabolic system, for example, the appetite-regulating hormones, your blood sugar. And then upstairs in the brain, you described a beautiful sort of description of a crew that comes in, a sort of a service crew, almost like a support crew. We also know that in the brain during deep sleep at night, there is a sewage system that kicks into high gear, and it washes away all of the metabolic detritus that's been building up within the brain. And the reason that's been a remarkable discovery is because one of the toxic byproducts that sleep washes away at night is a protein called beta amyloid. And beta amyloid is one of the leading candidate causes of Alzheimer's disease. And this is why we now understand why people who don't sleep enough across their lifespan have a far higher and significantly higher risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. We believe because the brain is not getting the opportunity to wash away that toxic Alzheimer's-related brain pathology profile.
Where does the beta amyloid protein go? I mean, where do these products of the wash at night go?
What's wonderful is that we have a bathing solution within our brain. It's called cerebrospinal fluid. And it's that fluid that actually evacuates and jettisons that, and then it goes down into the body and it's broken down and it's excreted. So your body has a sewage system that everyone knows about. It's called the lymphatic system. But your brain, we recently discovered, also has its own sewage system too. And it works by way of this spinal fluid, this wonderful bathing bath at night that sort of, it's good night, sleep clean, as it were.
There are two main factors, as you point out in the book, that determine when we feel like it's time to sleep. Can you lay those out for us?
The two factors are actually your 24-hour circadian rhythm, which just rises in the morning and peaks in the middle of the morning and then starts to scale down into the afternoon and the evening. And as it scales down, you start to feel drowsy. So you have this beautiful, natural sort of 24-hour pacemaker. It's almost like the pacemaker in your heart, but rather than beating perhaps, you know, once every second, it actually beats once every 24 hours, as it were, and that helps regulate your wake and sleep schedules according to light and dark. The second factor, however, is simply the amount of time that you've been awake. And the longer that you're awake, the more a chemical builds up in your brain called adenosine. And that chemical essentially represents a sleepiness pressure. Now, it's not a hydraulic pressure in your brain. Don't worry. It's actually it's a chemical pressure. But the longer that you've been awake, the more sleepy you will feel. And after about 16 hours of being awake, there is enough of that sleepiness pressure that you should feel tired. You should be able to fall asleep and then stay asleep soundly. So it's those two factors that combine beautifully that, you know, sort of towards the evening, let's say 10, 11, midnight, that's where you're on this incredible downswing of your 24-hour rhythm. And it's just at that time, too, when you're getting these highest peak levels of sleepiness pressure. And these two beautiful things coinciding will lead to a healthy onset of sleep and a long and deep sleep and a sustained sleep at that.
The experiments to research the body rhythms are really interesting. In fact, this sounds like the setup to a joke, but two scientists walk into a cave with their beds. This really happened.
It did. And what we used to think was that there was a clock somewhere in the brain or the body that kept its own 24-hour rhythm. And that's true, but with a slight caveat in the story, which is that if left to our own devices, our internal 24-hour clock is not precisely 24 hours. So our clock is not as precise as a Swiss quartz clockmaker. They would not be proud of the clock inside of our brain. The reason is because it runs a little longer than 24 hours. And the way we discovered this was that two scientists back in the 1960s took themselves up to Mammoth Cave in Kentucky, the deepest cave in the world, where there is no light, no daylight that penetrates it. So they were cut off from the natural light-dark cycle of the world. And then they measured their body rhythms. And both of those scientists actually shifted gradually from a precise 24-hour rhythm to about 25 or 26 hours. So for every day on the surface of the planet, they were gaining an extra hour or two because their watch, their internal clock, was a little bit slow or laggy. So what we realized is that we do have a clock, and it beats at about 24 hours, but we need other factors such as daylight to essentially act like the fingers on a wristwatch that pop the sort of the dial out on the side of that wristwatch and just set it back to precisely 24 hours each day. So we need a little help from the sun to reset our laggy biological clock.
Matthew Walker is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. We have an email from Patricia Ann in Eureka who wants to know, is there a relationship or what is the relationship between moonlight and melatonin?
Well, moonlight, we know, probably doesn't quite have the lux, which is the intensity of light, to actually alter or prevent the rise of melatonin. So moonlight, we think, may not be that influential. However, there's a really fascinating set of studies, which is that we do tend to get less sleep around a full moon, which could actually argue the other way. And you see this beautifully. If you track the total amount of sleep that people are getting according to the lunar phase, there's this interesting dip around the full moon time. Now, the problem is that if you look at areas where there has been cloud, which blocks the the influence of that full moon, you still see the dip in that sleep time. So there's clearly something going on with the lunar cycle and our sleep, which sounds very almost charlatan science. It sounds, right, you know, very hand-wavy, but the science is actually very compelling. So I think there's something to do with the lunar cycle. It may not be light itself from the moon, but something else. It may be pressure, or it may be other aspects that are related to that lunar cycle.
And you mentioned adenosine, but Patricia Ann was asking about the melatonin. That is another thing that, that occurs naturally in our bodies and increases as the day goes on, as we get closer to bedtime.
It should do. And the way that melatonin works is that as darkness ensues, the breaks that are placed on the release of melatonin in your brain are gradually released. So as you get sort of darkness pervading into your eyes, melatonin will start to rise. And the darker it gets, the more melatonin is released. And melatonin helps you time when you're going to sleep. Now, this is a problem not so much for the moon, but actually for the invasion of technology, particularly light, because we are a dark-deprived society in this modern world. And tablets, phones, computer screens, these seem to have a damaging impact on melatonin. They place the brakes on melatonin when otherwise melatonin should be rising. So our brain is fooled into thinking that it's still daytime, even though it's night outside. And that does have a harmful effect on our sleep.
So jet lag, for example, is when we get a little out of whack with light and dark cycles that our body expects. Is there a way to short circuit that or to get over it sooner? What are some of the things that research has found out about that?
There are some tips for people. It's still going to be hard because your body was never designed to be fast-forwarded or dragged back in time by way of this remarkable invention called the jet engine. And we know that for most people, for every one day you're in a new time zone, your body can only adjust by about 1 hour. So if I fly from California to London, which is 8 hours ahead, it's going to take me about 8 days. There are some things I can do to help me adjust. Firstly, I can try and get lots of daylight in the morning in the new time zone. So going outside is great for at least an hour in the new time zone. Take your shades off. Wear some protection, but keep the shades off in the morning. In the afternoon, do the opposite. No problem going outside, but put shades on to try and encourage the release of melatonin. Also, eating at the same times that everyone else is eating in the new time zone. Try not to eat when you're hungry, but try to eat when everyone else is eating in the stable time zone, because food can actually help reset your biological clock more quickly. And then perhaps you can experiment with melatonin. Try to take melatonin maybe about 2 to 3 hours before you want to get to sleep in the new time zone. That can also be helpful as well.
Matthew Walker is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. He is the director of the Sleep and Neuroimaging Lab there. And he's written a book called Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange with some stories about sleep eluding you or perhaps welcoming you with open arms, the arms of Morpheus, I like to say. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We welcome Grumpy John in Grants Pass to the Exchange. Welcome.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Jeff, I have a question and a sleep story for you. My question is it possible that the longer circadian cycle that we are on now was established at a time in the far past when Earth's days were longer? I don't know, but that's my query. Mm-hmm. And here's my story. Back in the day, I had friends who hung with the Merry Pranksters, and I was visiting with them for a little bit. Neil Cassidy was there. He asked me if I could score some speed. I happened to know that my mother had some mother's little helpers in the form of bifetamine. So Neil and I drove out to the suburbs and hit my mom up for a few bifetamine tablets. We went back to Berkeley. It was evening. I saw Neil eat those two bifetamine tablets and then go to sleep. There's your sleep story.
All right. Thanks for that, Grumpy John. Appreciate it. So that sounds like a rather unusual response to amphetamine. But let's come back to his question too, Matthew, about circadian rhythms and whether we are slightly longer than 24 hours because of something evolutionarily.
I think it's a great idea. Unfortunately, what we see is that human beings are actually a little bit laggy in terms of having a longer biological clock. But if you look at other species, some of them will actually have a shorter biological clock. So not everyone is sort of laggy in the same way that we are. Some people have sort of some species have a clock that is maybe 23 and a half hours. Others, like ourselves, have about 24 and a half hours. So I don't think it seems to be the case that it was all directed by way of an earlier difference in the total day length. Otherwise, all species would be the same in terms of their delayed biological clock. And they're not. Some are shorter, some are longer.
So we haven't talked much about all the species that sleep. We're not the only ones by a long shot, but sleep can be very different from creature to creature, I understand. You describe things like birds sleeping with half the brain asleep and the other half awake to be alert, sea creatures, different cycles, that sort of thing. So, but is it universal? Do all animals sleep? Do plants sleep, for that matter, too?
Well, every species that we've studied so far sleeps. And I think that it sounds like a simple statement, but it actually has something profound within it. What that means is that sleep probably evolved with life itself on this planet. And from that point forward, sleep has fought its way through every step along the evolutionary path, which must mean by definition that sleep is essential at perhaps the most basic of biological levels. And that's exactly what the evidence now suggests. But that's not to say that all species sleep in the same way, and you describe some beautiful differences. So, for example, we know that birds and some aquatic mammals, for example, like dolphins, they will actually sleep with one half of their brain at certain times. And in birds, it's a great, fascinating story. Birds will often flock on a branch. They will all line up. Now, all of the birds in the middle, they will actually be sleeping with both halves of their brain at the same time, which they can also do. But the poor guys at the end, the far left and the far right, they will only sleep with half of their brain, meaning that the other half of the brain is awake, keeping the eye open on those two flankward left and right sides, essentially providing full 360 panoramic view protection for the flock. Now, you would think that after they've done their turn at the ends, then they would fold in and other people would take their turn. It's actually not true. What happens is that those sentinels, those bookends of the flock, after a while, they will stand up. They will each rotate 180 degrees. They will sit back down and then they will switch halves. So now the other half of the brain gets the chance to sleep. So it's this beautiful demonstration, but it also tells us once again how critical sleep is. Wouldn't it just have been easy in evolution to figure out a mechanism where we could just stay awake and not have to sleep because of all of the disadvantages that you could come up with? But we can't, because sleep is so essential that you've had to come up with these creative solutions so that the brain still gets the sleep that it needs, even in split shifts. Just remarkable.
Matthew Walker, again, our guest on The Exchange. His book is called Why We Sleep. I've been fascinated for a long time, Matthew, about the discussions of humans changing their sleep patterns over time. What is biphasic sleep and why did we stop?
Biphasic sleep is simply sleep that is taken in two bouts across a 24-hour period. And in most first world nations, the way in which we sleep is what's called monophasically. So we try to get one long 8-hour bout across the night, or we should be trying to get 8 hours. There was a practice that happened in medieval times called first and second sleep, where people would split the night. They would have maybe 3 or 4 hours, then they would wake up in the middle of the night, they would socialize, have activities, and then they would go for second sleep. That seems to be largely cultural, because there is no biology that we can see that should suggest we need to be sleeping like that. However, there is another form of biphasic sleep that does appear to be how we were designed to sleep, which is about 6.5 hours at night and then a siesta-like nap in the afternoon. And we know this because when we study cultures and tribes that have not been touched by the Industrial Revolution, by electricity, for example, hunter-gatherer tribes whose way of life actually hasn't changed for thousands of years. Those tribes actually sleep in this biphasic pattern, and they will go to sleep around 9 or 10 p.m. Then they will rise just before dawn as the temperature starts to rise, and then they will often have, particularly in the warm summer months, they will have a nap in the afternoon. And in fact, we were all designed perhaps to sleep in this way because there is a genetically hardwired dip in all of our levels of alertness somewhere between 1 to 4 p.m. And I think everyone knows this. You sort of around the boardroom table, heads are starting to nod and dip. Nothing to do with the big lunch. It's because perhaps we were designed to be napping in the afternoon.
Well, I think we should take the bodies up on that. So we'll talk more about the efficacy of napping and some fairly stark examples of what happened when people stopped taking naps in the afternoon. Matthew Walker is our guest on The Exchange. His book is Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. We'll come back and talk more with him and take more questions and comments from you by phone and email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're catching some Z's, or better than that, catching information on how we can catch some Z's with Matthew Walker, who is the director of the Sleep and Neuroimaging Laboratory at the University of California, Berkeley, where he's a professor of neuroscience and psychology. He's the author of the book, Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. You can join this conversation on The Exchange, a hot topic always, how to get a better night's sleep and make it work better for us. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about biphasic sleep and the indication that perhaps the body does want us to take a nap between 1 and 4 p.m. You cite an example in Greece, Matthew, of a community where people had been doing the afternoon siesta and closing up shops and then, I guess for economic reasons, stopped doing that. What were the health effects from no longer taking the afternoon nap?
It was quite a concerning study, and they looked at this in Greece when they started to do away with that siesta-like behavior. And they tracked well over 20,000 men and women aged 20 all the way up to, I think, the mid-80s. And they measured the consequence of this sort of absence of the siesta-like behavior. What they found was that those people who stopped having that nap in the afternoon ended up having about a 34% increased risk of dying from a heart attack as a consequence of that lost sleep. In fact, it was especially prominent in working males. There was actually a 64% increased risk of death from cardiovascular incidents. So I think it was a very good piece of evidence to describe how damaging a lack of sleep can be to our cardiovascular system. We also know this, by the way, from something that's coming up, which is daylight savings time. It's perhaps the largest sleep experiment that's done, 1.6 billion people twice a year. And what we know is that in the spring, when we lose an hour of sleep, we see a 24% increase in heart attacks. Yet in the fall, which is coming up, when we gain an hour of sleep opportunity, there is a 21% decrease in heart attacks. So that's how fragile and vulnerable our cardiovascular system is to even just the smallest change, the perturbation of sleep. I should also note, by the way, naps are a bit of a double-edged sword, though. You have to be a little bit careful. If you are struggling with sleep at night, the advice is that you shouldn't nap during the day. Because as we're awake during the day, we build up lots of this healthy sleep pressure. And the longer you're awake, the sleepier you feel. And after about 16 hours, you'll fall asleep and stay asleep if you've got enough of that sleepiness. When you take a nap, it's like a pressure valve on that pressure cooker. You release some of that sleepiness, and therefore it can make it that much more difficult to fall asleep at night. So the advice is, if you don't struggle with sleep and you can nap regularly, then naps are just fine. But if you do have difficulties with sleep, stay away from naps and remain awake across the day.
which addresses a question that we have from Larry. I don't see his community listed here from his email, but he asks about whether midday napping can affect our night sleep. The answer is yes, it can. But he also asks, can we replace an hour of night sleep with a midday nap?
Certainly, we know that naps actually do give these brain and body benefits. So it seems as though sleep in general does seem to provide benefits, whether it's perhaps in the afternoon with a nap or at night. I would say this, though, however, that trying to completely switch your schedule, for example, if you're working night shifts, 8 hours of sleep during the day is not going to be the same quality of sleep as 8 hours at night, because we weren't designed to be trying to get all of our sleep during the day. And that's why I think there are significantly higher risks of numerous diseases in nighttime shift workers. So just a quick caveat for that point. But overall, naps we found in our own work at My Sleep Center and other people, lots of other scientists, they do offer some benefits, some significant benefits.
All right. We people who take naps during the day really appreciate hearing that information. Cecilia in Rogue River, thank you for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Matthew Walker.
Oh, hi, Jeffrey and Matthew. Thank
Hello.
You. Now that I've gotten older, I slept really well when I was younger. But as I've gotten older, I usually have to get up at least twice a night to go to the restroom. Or now I'm getting a lot of leg cramps or foot cramps where it's impossible to sleep. You have to get up. You have to actually walk around or at least stand. And it's very disruptive to sleep. Do you have any suggestions for that?
All right, or observations for sure. Thanks for that, Cecilia.
It's a very difficult point. We have done a lot of work in this area of sleep and aging. One of the things that you can do is obviously try to start to limit to a degree the fluid intake that you have at night. Some people will have a glass of water. One thing you could try to do is just sip the water rather than try to drink the whole glass and try to reduce that fluid intake. But it is one of those problems, that more frequent bathroom trips, as well as pain, physical pain in the body, is another problem for many people, and it does come on to the cramps as well. I would suggest that you perhaps go to see your doctor or even to try and see a sleep doctor, because there are perhaps some medication options that may help with the muscles and help with the cramps. It could actually be related to aspects of certain iron, not iron in terms of the compound itself, but certain chemicals within the body could be corrected. So things like magnesium are a muscle relaxant that's been used for sleep to some degree of success. But I would speak to your doctor, and they may actually have some good solutions for those cramps.
Let's take another call here from Bob and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Matthew Walker.
Yes, I'm entering my 80s, and I'm having more and more trouble sleeping enough at night. And so my question is, why? As a person ages, is that just a necessary component? And is it necessary for older people to get as much sleep as younger people?
All right. Good question. Thanks for that, Bob.
It's a great question. And it is one of the myths that I tried to address in the book, which is that older adults simply need less sleep. And we know that that's not true. It seems to be that older adults need just as much sleep as they did when they were in the 30s or 40s. One of the problems, in addition to the things that we just mentioned, is that the brain itself in older age simply cannot physiologically generate the sleep that it still necessarily needs. And we're trying to develop ways and methods for actually electrically helping the brain at night and give back that deep sleep that seems to be missing in older age, and see if we could salvage aspects of mental and physical health in aging. So that's one of our moonshot goals at My Sleep Center. But it is a problem, and I do want to recognize that as we get older, sleep does get worse. It's not that we need less sleep, and we're starting to understand exactly why sleep gets worse in aging, and maybe think about treatment intervention possibilities.
Our listeners are helping each other. We did have a caller who dropped off a home remedy for the muscle cramps and says a light amount of dill pickle juice helps with the leg cramps. It's what some people in the NFL use, which brings us to your work with professional athletes and sleep as a remedy for injuries. Talk about that a bit, Matthew.
I do. I've been fortunate enough to work with many professional teams, both in the U.S. and also in the U.K. And I think there is a growing realization that sufficient sleep is perhaps one of the best legal performance-enhancing drugs that you could imagine. It's a competitive advantage. Certainly, we know that people who are getting less sleep are markedly more likely to get injured during a season. And it really is quite dramatic, the difference between getting 9 hours or 7 hours of sleep. You almost double your risk of injury if you're getting just 7 hours versus 9 hours. We also know, however, that sleep is not just wonderful for preparing you for peak physical performance the next day. Sleep is actually just as critical the night after a game, because sleep will actually help with recovery. It will boost the immune system, and it will reduce acute as well as chronic inflammation. And of course, with professional athletes, you tend not to just have one game. You're constantly playing games. So recovery is just as big a part of the performance-enhancing equation as is setting up for the game the night prior. So on both sides of the game equation, sleep is critical.
So we were talking largely about the health effects of sleep and haven't gone at all into the area of the book where you do talk about dreams at length. And here's a great sentence. Last night you became flagrantly psychotic. Is that what dreaming is?
You could define it like that. And why would I levy that charge against all of us, myself included, last night? Well, the reason is because last night you started to see things which weren't there. So you were hallucinating. You believed things that couldn't possibly be true. So you were delusional. You became confused about time and place as well as person. So you're suffering from disorientation. You had wildly fluctuating emotions, something that we call being affectively labile. And then how wonderful, we all woke up this morning and we forgot most, if not all, of that dream experience. So we're suffering from amnesia. So on any one of those grounds, but especially as a collective, if you experience them while you're awake, you would be actually probably seeking psychological or psychiatric treatment. Yet, for reasons that we are only now starting to understand, it's a normal psychological state at night during this thing that we call dream sleep.
And so I mean, you've done some fMRI scans, and God knows how you got the fMRI quiet enough for people to be able to sleep through it. But what do they show? Do our brains act differently when we dream?
There is just such a remarkable change. I mean, I still thrill at the delight of looking at the dreaming brain in action in the sleep center. And it does. Dream sleep is a remarkably active state of the brain. In fact, some parts of your brain are up to 30% more active in dream sleep than when you're awake, which was a quite startling finding, because our body seems to be still and at rest. And those centers are actually the emotional centers and the memory centers. But we also know that during dream sleep, it's a time when we shut off a critical stress-related chemical called noradrenaline. And it is the sister chemical in the brain of one that everyone knows about in the body called adrenaline. And the brain's version is noradrenaline. And we now understand that dreaming is a wonderful neurochemical state where we reprocess emotional experiences, but in this safe chemical environment. And it's almost like a nocturne soothing balm, that dream sleep takes those sharp, painful edges and the sting out of those difficult experiences so that we wake up the next morning feeling better. So dream sleep is a form of overnight therapy, we now understand. It's emotional first aid.
Can we guide our dreams, Matthew? Can we decide what to dream, things like that?
About 20% of the population do seem to be able to do this, and we classify them as being lucid or lucid dreamers. Some people stumble upon this. Some people try to practice methods to encourage this. And we used to think in science it was maybe a bit of a stretch to make that claim, but there have now been some incredibly good scientific studies that I describe in the book, studies that I'm desperately jealous of because they're so wonderful in how they were conceived. I wish I'd done them myself. And they show without, I think, shadow of a doubt that there is such a thing as people being able to control their dreams. There is such a thing as lucid dreaming. So, yes, it does seem to be true and scientifically validated.
We have a couple of questions here dealing with substances. One drop-off question from a name I don't see, that you mentioned the impact of alcohol and caffeine. This guest wants to know about sugar and marijuana. And then Ken in Ashland is asking a similar question about CBD oil derived from hemp or cannabis, which he says he takes as a tincture and helps him sleep beautifully. So marijuana and sugar are on the table here as questions about sleep.
In terms of diet, what we know is that diets that are high in sugar and low in fiber tend not to be good for sleep. They cause a sleep disruption, and you tend to have less deep sleep. Although I should note that it seems as though a diet that's high in sugar and low in fiber is bad for just about every aspect of health, and sleep is part of that problem equation. Marijuana is interesting. People do use it as a sleep aid. It may be able to help people fall asleep faster and sort of disengage the anxiety or the spinning wheels of the mind. Sadly, however, we know that marijuana can also actually block your dream sleep. It does it by a different mechanism, but in the same way that alcohol will block your dream sleep, marijuana can do that too. So the advice currently is that people should look for healthier ways to try and get the sleep that they need rather than ways that can actually subvert or block certain critical stages.
So before we go then, an indication of what is a good amount of sleep. Are people kidding themselves if they think they're fine on 4 to 6 hours?
They are, sadly. We know that once you get below 7 hours of sleep, we can measure objective impairments in your brain and your body. So hence the 8-hour recommendation.
All right. So much to read in the book that we didn't get to. It's by Matthew Walker at the University of California, Berkeley, where he runs the Sleep and Neuroimaging Lab. The book is called Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. Matthew, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Sleep well.
All right. Take care. You too.